This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Mel Brooks. Among his many achievements is this song, which might be an anthem for the new year.
Hope for the best.
Expect the worst. Some drink champagne, some die of thirst. No way of knowing which way it's going. Hope for the best.
A song by Mel Brooks from his film The 12 Chairs. We're starting the new year with a little bit of bad taste. For example, what's more tasteless than turning the Spanish Inquisition into a lavish song and dance number? How about a Broadway musical saluting Adolf Hitler? These are the kinds of insane spectacles that fans like me love Mel Brooks for. Think of the contributions he's made to American comedy. He was a writer on Sid Caesar's Your Show of Shows. He created The 2,000-Year-Old Man with Carl Reiner, co-created the TV series Get Smart, and made such movies as The Producers, Blazing Saddles, History of the World Part 1, and High Anxiety. We recorded this interview after his latest movie, Life Stinks. Before we meet Mel Brooks, let's listen to a song he wrote for his comedy, The Producers, a film about two Broadway producers who come up with a convoluted scheme to get rich quick by producing the worst musical ever made, Springtime for Hitler.
Germany was having trouble, what a sad, sad story. Needed a new leader to restore its former glory. Where, oh, where was he?
Where could that man be?
We looked around, and then we found the man for you and me. And now it's
springtime for Hitler and Germany. Deutschland is happy and gay.
We're marching to a faster pace. Look out, here comes the master race.
Springtime for Hitler and Germany.
Winter for Poland and France.
Springtime for Hitler and Germany. Come on, Germans, go into your dance.
You know, some of my very favorite Mel Brooks moments are your big production numbers, your Broadway showstoppers with big choruses for grim and totally inappropriate subjects like Springtime for Hitler and The Producers, or The Inquisition, What a Show, and History of the World, Part 1. Did you want to be on Broadway for real when you were growing up, or did you want to be a song and dance man?
To be perfectly frank, yes. The answer to all those questions is yes, yes! I wanted more than anything. I wanted to sing and dance and jump up and down on Broadway, and even more than that, on the big silver screen. And my heroes when I was young were, of course, Fred Astaire and Gene Kelly. And I loved all those great old black and white musicals like The Gay Divorcee and Top Hat and the color movies that MGM made with Gene Kelly, you know, and fantastic. And I loved Singing in the Rain. I mean, who doesn't love a great musical? And in all of my movies, whether it's proper or not, I squeeze in a number, you know?
So when you were growing up and you really wanted to be on Broadway or to be a song and dance man, how far did you get with that? Or how far did you think you could get singing and dancing? Did you have...
Oh, I did it. But I did it in the sour cream factories of the Borscht Belt and the Catskills, just outside of New York. There were these resort hotels. And you started by just tending the rowboats or being a busboy, and you prayed to end up on stage, you know, in a variety show on Saturday night. And I became a drummer, and I got onto the stage because the comic got sick. So the boss, Pincus Cohen, redundant name, he didn't need both Pincus and Cohen. One would have been, said, used to call me Melbum, M-E-L-B-M-N-N-N-N. He'd say, Melbum, the comic is sick, and we know you're cute and funny, so jump on the stage and amuse the guests. So that night I went on the stage, and I never went back to the drums.
What'd you do that night?
Well, that night I did a different... It's a good question, Terry. I like you, Terry Gross. this is going to be a great show because I like you and I like me. So when I listen to this, I'm going to be in heaven, you know. What did I do? That night I did a different kind of comedy because there was a maid who was locked in the closet that day. She had somehow locked herself in a broom closet, in a storeroom closet, and she couldn't get out. And she was pounding on the door and screaming in Yiddish, "Los mir reis! Los mir reis!" and screaming. And finally somebody heard her, opened the door, and let her out. So they let Sophie out, and she had a little attack of tears and nerves, and then went back to taking care of the rooms. So everybody at the place knew it. It was like a scandal. Poor Sophie. Ay, ay, ay. So when the first thing I did that night, I said, "Good evening, ladies and Jews." You know, I did my thing. And I said, "Los mi arroz!" I just screamed. And the place went, it was pandemonium, you know, because they knew about it. And I decided to do like real comedy, people's comedy, or comedy that everybody knew instead of making up, quote, jokes. And I've been doing that kind of comedy ever since.
I want to get back to your big, big lavish production numbers like Springtime for Hitler. What possessed you the first time you did one of those? Like Springtime for Hitler, for instance. It's such a wonderful and really funny number, and I'm sure a lot of people thought it was just in horrible taste.
It was in horrible taste. It was in execrable taste. I'm ashamed of it to this day, but I do like that juxtaposition of those two textures, you know. But let me tell you, the song itself, composed, but nobody knows I wrote the music as well as made up those words. So I wrote the words and the music to Springtime for Hitler. The song is beautiful. People listen to it even today, and they don't know it's Springtime for Hitler. They listen to the orchestration, or they listen to the non-vocal version of it in many cities. I was just in Chicago. There is an elevator playing Springtime for Hitler.
Really?
And there are people going up and down, but it just goes da-da-da-dee-da-da-da-da-da. They don't know it's Springtime for Hitler and Germany. They don't know that. They just hear the music and they sway till they get to the 22nd floor, you know. And it's amazing. And so the melody is almost like a Richard Rodgers melody. And that's why when you hear these crazy words against it, it all falls into place beautifully.
What do you think your most misunderstood scene is in any of your movies?
I think that's a good question, Terry Gross. That's a very good question. What is my most misunderstood or misinterpreted theme? Yeah, vulgarity or bad taste. I use it, therefore I'm painted with that brush. The critics and a lot of people don't understand that bad taste is a wonderful device for unearthing truth that is all around us and evoking laughter. So that is the bane of my existence is that I'm continually accused, like the overhead shot of the swastika in Springtime for Hitler. I mean, it was a very important point in a very important musical and a very important story. So I don't think they just single out, you know, something that they feel is in horrible taste, but they don't know that it's used to illuminate something.
My guest is Mel Brooks. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Screenwriter, director, and actor Mel Brooks is my guest. His new movie is Life Stinks. What kind of roles do you think you would have gotten if you weren't writing your own?
Oh, my favorite role would be the King of Germany, the Kaiser role. That would be, no. Two demerits for that. I can't help. Look, when you work in the mountains, it never leaves you. You know, cheap jokes. I mean, I'm a purveyor of cheap jokes. Now, what kind of roles would I say again, Terry?
What kind of roles do you think you would have gotten in movies if you weren't writing your own?
Well, in the 30s, I probably would have been a bellboy in hotel movies. you know. And then I guess in the 40s, I would have been, you know, like a good-natured soldier from Brooklyn. I know the roles they would have given me. They would have called me Brooklyn. Hey, Brooklyn, you know. And then in the 50s, I would have been the band boy with the rock and roll group, you know, touring this. I know that's why I wrote these movies, you know, or else I would have been stuck with all these parts. I would have been called Blinky and Winky and Nod.
Before you started writing for the Sid Caesar Show, did you have any outwardly Jewish people to see yourself in, outside of the Catskill comics, but people who were not only Jewish in show business, but were doing sketches about being Jewish, or who were writing stories about being Jewish, or, you know, who were Jewish in any outward way?
Good question. No. The only role models had gone away, and that was Yiddish theater. You know, the Yiddish theater of Second Avenue in New York. And that was long gone by the time I had made my way into show business. I had only seen one play. And the second act of the Yiddish theater was an incredible device. It was great. It was the most emotional point in the play. This is the second act curtain I'm talking about, before you went into the third act. This is to hold the audience so they would sit for the third act. And the daughter would come home to them. She was missing, and she would come home. And she would enter stage left, and the mother was stage right looking at her. And she would open her coat, and she would show this big belly. And the mother would scream in Yiddish, "Er ist schwanger!" And she'd faint, and the curtain would come down. And that is, the mother would say, "She's pregnant." So, and they always had, or a soldier would come home and the mother would say, it is blind, he's blind, and then the curtain would come. I mean, they always had this, they had these tragically emotional moments. And I learned that somehow, at the end of the second act, and I do that in all my movies, you've got to hook the people so they're excited about at least the denouement. I mean, the rush to the end, you know?
Your parents were Eastern European immigrants. Was mostly Yiddish spoken in your house?
No. My grandmother did. My mother, as a matter of fact, said Earl and Burl. She was a New Yorker. You know, she came here when she was 3 years old. She learned English from, as most immigrants did when they came here as little kids, they learned English from Irish teachers. Irish teachers in New York. And they were the Irish got all the jobs, so therefore all the teachers were Irish, and everybody was talking like this in Jewish households. Hey, Mershi, would you pass the kasha? Thank you very much, Mersh. I mean, I'm overdoing it, but my mother did say turlet. She never said toilet. She said turlet, like the Irish do.
If you're just joining us, Mel Brooks is my guest, and his new movie is called Life Stinks. He co-wrote it, he directed it, and he stars in it. Can I hear about what your bar mitzvah was like?
It was fast and short. In those days, they were not. Today, I just went to a bar mitzvah, and it could have fed all of Kiev, where my mother came from. It's an amazing difference. My bar mitzvah took 15 minutes, and the kids threw hard candy, and a couple of them hit me with it, and it was all over. And of course, I'll never forget the breath of my Rebbe. I mean, Rebbe breath is famous. I mean, they eat garlics and onions, and then they try to teach you Hebrew, and they would breathe in your face and say, "No, not chu, not." And it was quite an experience. And ask any little Jewish kid who's bar mitzvahed about Rebbe breath.
A lot of your movies are parodies of genre films. When did you fall in love with movies? Did you go a lot when you were young?
I went a lot, and I didn't have a lot of money, so the way I used to get into movies was when the audience, when the movie would break and the audience would walk out, I would join them, and I would walk backwards until I was in the theater.
Oh, so it looked like you were exiting.
In the back row,
yeah.
And then when the new audience came in, I would watch the movie. And that was the only way I could get to see movies, because I couldn't afford the whatever it was, the 15 cents to get in to see them. And my mother used to search for me in the movies, because I would see the same movie, you know, if it was Top Hat or The Gay Divorce, forget about it. I'd see it 16 times. I knew every step. I knew every nuance, every lilt, every note, every fill. I was addicted. I was addicted to movies.
I want to get back to something we were talking about before. You know how you were saying if you weren't writing your own roles, you'd be like the bellboy in the movie or whatever. When you realized that as much as you loved song and dance and Broadway shows and musical comedy movies, when you realized that you probably weren't going to be a leading man, you weren't going to be cast as a leading man, well, eventually you started casting yourself as a leading man in parodies of those kinds of movies. But were you ever really heartbroken knowing that you wouldn't be in the serious versions of those movies?
That's a good question. Yeah, in my heart of hearts, I always wanted to be Errol Flynn. Yeah, I was heartbroken. And I always wanted the most beautiful, long-waisted, long-legged women in the world to fall on their knees and pray to me. But as life and God would have it, it was the other way around. Every time I see a tall, beautiful woman, I just crash to my knees and I pray to her. I say, please, just give me a slap in the face, something. Show me that you know I'm alive too. I made myself a leading man in high anxiety because I always wanted to imitate Frank Sinatra. So here was a chance to write a song called High Anxiety and sing it at a bar, which was a dream of mine. And I made myself a leading man because in real life I knew I could never be a leading man.
Well, I'm going to play some of High Anxiety.
Oh, thanks, Ter.
High anxiety whenever you're near. High anxiety, it's you that I fear. My heart's afraid to fly. It's crashed before. But then you take my hand, my heart starts to soar. Once more, high anxiety, it's always the same. Anxiety, it's you that I blame. It's very clear to me I've got to give in. My anxiety, you win.
Mel Brooks, I want to get to a different side of what you do, and that's the movies that you produce. Because, you know, Brooks Films has done movies like The Elephant Man, and you had David Lynch direct that, and The Fly. Mm-hmm. David Cronenberg directed that. What I'm interested in here is that it seems to me you produce these serious, moody films that are so different from the kinds of films you direct and write and star in. It seems like it's another part of you, but it's one that I guess you feel more comfortable in the position of producer rather than writer, director, or star.
True. Because I have not been allowed to do, quote, serious things, allowed by my image, you do something, and then the public and the critics, too, want you to do it until you're dead. And they won't allow you to change your shape or form or express yourself in a different manner because, you know, hey, pal, you know, we're paying for vanilla. You know, don't give us chocolate. And so I formed this kind of sub rosa under the table in the closet company called Brooks Films. And I kept my name, the Mel. I keep the Mel away, I said.
But are these films that you would like to be making yourself in a way?
Well, in a way, I've kind of put it together in Life Stinks. And it's kind of the first time I've stepped out of the closet. So here I am, Mel Brooks and Brooks Films all in one movie. And I'm very happy with it. You know, I'm very happy I was allowed to do it. And it was a great experience. But I've never been allowed to fuse the quiet, dark, serious elements in me and the happy-go-lucky, silly comic.
So many of your movies seem to be about, isn't it absurd that I would be in this position here? Or isn't it absurd that a Jew like me would be in this position here? I'm wondering about the circumstances in your life where you felt like the Jew. Were there instances where you felt that way? Or did you grow up in a neighborhood where just about everybody was Jewish and came from families and background
yes, I
like
felt,
you did?
Actually, I felt I had great compassion and pity for the few Catholic people that were living in our ghetto because in Williamsburg in Brooklyn, because I felt these poor people, these Christians, I mean, they're in the minority. We should help them. We should be kind to them. You know, I never thought that we, you know, and then I was drafted and I was in the army and I said, wait a minute. I mean, there are 10,000 guys here and I'm the only Jew. What's happened? You know, I began to realize that maybe we weren't the majority, and, you know. Anyway, I think that I learned a lot. I learned a lot because there were people who hated me in the Army just because they found out I was a Jew. And then I made sure that they got to know me and not just what, you know, they thought I was. And usually I could make sense to them about who I was and what I was, you know. It was really interesting. I mean, the Army was a very interesting experience. Of course, war is very loud, and it's, you know, people are trying to kill you. I mean, they don't even know your last name, and they're shooting at you, you know. So it's very, very disturbing. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not what I want to do for the rest of my life. I knew that. After my first combat where these Germans were trying to kill me, I said, I'm going to get into show business. I knew that that's what I wanted to do. Singing and dancing was going to be a lot better than this. War is heck.
Well, Mel Brooks, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Okay, Terry Gross, keep in touch. Don't be strange. And keep up the great work. I love your stuff. Say hello to Philadelphia for me. Bye-bye.
Mel Brooks, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.